Hello and welcome to Midori House. We're live from Studio One at Monocle 24 and I'm Emma Barnett. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, how has Lebanon been affected by the violence in Syria? We speak to our Beirut correspondent Carol Corm to find out. Monocle's culture editor Robert Bound will be here to run through the week's cultural events and best music. We'll also be talking to the key speaker at tomorrow's London School of Economics event, The Miracle of Mauritius. And has Mitt Romney's dog cruelty antics from 2007 come back to bite him? We'll be speaking to one of the protesters from Dog Against Romney to hear more. All that plus some of our favourite music right here on Midori House live on Monocle 24. And now the latest news from around the world with Jonathan Wheatley.
Monocle 24 News. Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has offered to hold multi-party elections within 4 months while his troops continue to attack opposition strongholds of Homs and Hama. Elite Syrian forces backed by armoured personnel carriers also stormed parts of the capital Damascus today. Iran's oil ministry has denied state media reports that the Islamic country was stopping its crude exports to 6 European countries. Iran's English language Press TV had earlier said Tehran had stopped exporting oil to France, Portugal, Italy, Greece, the Netherlands and Spain in response to EU sanctions. The head of France's influential oil industry body, UFIP, has said he was not overtly worried by the reports. UFIP head Jean-Louis Sicansley told Reuters the main worry was about Iran, but was actually a geopolitical one. Israeli nationals in India have today said they feel safe despite an attack outside their embassy in New Delhi. India said on Tuesday it was still unsure who was behind the Monday attack on the Israeli woman's car by a motorbike rider who attached an explosive to the rear door and fled. It had been pointedly silent on Israel's accusation that Tehran was the culprit. 4 were injured in that attack, including the wife of an Israeli defence attaché working at the embassy. One Israeli national residing in Mumbai, Moses Joseph, has said that many times in the past has been a target for militant attacks, but said that the country was actually safe for him.
In Mumbai we are quite safe. You know, there is now a terrorist attack, okay, now we have to, that is bad. There is like bed bugs, they come and bite and go. So no, you can't blame the government, you can't blame the police for it.
At least 10 countries, including the United States and the United Kingdom, have issued travel alerts to Bangkok in light of the recent bombings in the Thai capital. Ambassadors from more than 30 embassies met at the foreign ministry this afternoon, a day after 3 explosions rocked the busy Ekamai area in eastern Bangkok. The government has called for heightened security in tourist spots. A man identified as Saeed Moradi was carrying an Iranian passport when he lost a leg after a bomb he was carrying went off yesterday after an early explosion, apparently accidental, at a house he was renting. His other leg had to be amputated. Thai officials are now asking for help from the Iranian embassy with the investigation.
They already told me before I go that there are some terrorist threats in Bangkok and I should be warned, and I am. And so I try not to be in places with loads of tourists because I heard they want to reach the tourists. But overall I feel really safe here. It's great.
That was 22-year-old Dutch tourist Kaz Gerbonzen. Britain's Queen Elizabeth, accompanied by the Duke of Edinburgh, has attended a Diamond Jubilee multi-faith reception at Lambeth Palace here in London. On arrival, the royal party were met by the Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams and Mrs. Williams. The Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh met with representatives of the 8 non-Christian religions in the state drawing room, including Baha'i, Buddhist, Hindu, Jain, Jewish, Muslim and Sikh, as well as Christian representatives. They each presented a treasured object or text of importance to their faith. Following this, they attended a reception in the guard room, at which the Queen gave a speech.
This gathering is a reminder of how much we owe the 9 major religious traditions represented here. They are sources of a rich cultural heritage and have given rise to beautiful sacred objects and holy texts, as we have seen today. Yet these traditions are also contemporary families of faith. Our religions provide critical guidance for the way we live our lives.
Finally, in Bogota, Catholic priests have hired hitmen to kill them when one was diagnosed with HIV/AIDS. Rafael Ortega and Richard Pifano paid about $8,000 for the hit. 2 of the 4 assassins were arrested. Both priests were shot dead. And those are the stories at the top of the hour on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. So let's have a quick look at the front pages of some of the Australasian press that we've got here, starting with the Sydney Morning Herald.
Indeed. I've got a story about the union bosses saying, whatever you do, do not dump Prime Minister Julia Gillard. You may be aware, of course, that the Labour Party previously dumped Kevin Rudd. And yesterday we were talking about the fact that there were rumours that Julia Gillard had already planned to dump Kevin Rudd weeks before it actually came to light. And we were talking about that yesterday on the same programme yesterday. So senior union figures are urging the Gillard government MPs contemplating changing leaders yet again to consider the political disaster that the New South Wales Labour Party will happen to the New South Wales Labour Party. So that's quite an interesting story because, of course, we know that Julia Gillard is holding on now perhaps to a two-seat majority because one of the Liberal members of Parliament became Speaker. So she originally only had one seat majority in a coalition with five independents or four independents, but now she's in government with a seat of two majority because one of the Liberals is now the Speaker. But it's still a wafer-thin majority. And
she is skating
she's in
on
trouble.
Slightly thin ice.
She's
now,
in trouble,
isn't she?
Yes, but exactly.
Let's see if anybody listens to those union bosses. And moving on to the New Zealand Herald, it's a fantastic photo, isn't it, on the front page here?
Exactly. This is more on an outdoor story. In America, they call them tornadoes. In New Zealand, they call them twisted water spouts.
Water spouts. Yes. I've never seen anything like it.
Where was it? It was near Waitaki Marama Harbour in Auckland.
Yes.
This moved along the harbour past the central business district before growing weaker and drifting into a thick cloud over the city. Weather Watch head analyst Philip Duncan estimated the water spout was at least half a kilometre tall, that's about a third of a mile, and 50 metres wide with wind speeds of 70 miles per hour or 120 kilometres per hour. Quite extraordinary.
It's insane. I mean, it just looks, you can't actually tell when you look at this picture whether the spout of water is coming up from the ground or if it's coming out of the cloud. But anyway, so certainly, as the headline says, a twist on summer. So thank you very much.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
OK, well, now it's time for the World Weather Report with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather. In association with Kuoni Travel.
Middle of the week in Europe, very snowy in the Alps, Austria, Poland and Hungary. Many of the major cities getting a fresh blanket of snow, certainly a risk of air travel disruption. By Thursday, the snow will stop falling though. Across Western Europe, we've noticed a big rise in the temperatures by the end of the week, highs of 12 degrees in the UK and France. But in far Eastern Europe, still on the cold side, night temperatures of minus 15 degrees. It's Thursday's City Outlook. In London, 10 degrees, partly cloudy. Munich, zero and snow. Warsaw, minus 4, sunshine and snow showers. Budapest, zero with a few snow flurries. North America now, and pleasant winter sunshine this Wednesday along the US Atlantic coast. Good weather also in southern Quebec and in Ontario. Come Thursday, however, the clouds will gather and snow showers or rain, depending where you are. Here is Thursday's City Outlook. In Toronto, 4 degrees with hazy skies. Chicago, 2 Celsius with a rain and snow mix. Washington, D.C., cloudy, 10 degrees here. San Francisco, 14 and sunny. Here's a look at some other world locations and Asia Pacific. In Hong Kong, a cloudy few days with some rain, 18 to 20 degrees. You might be on business in Shanghai. Fairly good weather here for the rest of the week, but a chilly 6 degrees. And in Tokyo, damp and chilly Thursday. Friday is looking a little bit better, around 5 degrees here. That's all from the Weather Desk. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
It's 18:09 in London and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
Esse é Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 talat, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 är jag också.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Emma Barnett. Now, Lebanon is beginning to feel the impact of escalating violence over the border in Syria, with clashes in the northern city of Tripoli. Two adjoining neighbourhoods reflect the growing concern that the violence raging in Syria could soon spill into Lebanon, whose own sectarian civil war captivated the world a generation ago. How bad, though, is the violence, and what does it mean for Lebanon? Joining me down the line is Monocle's Beirut correspondent, Carol Corm. Hello, Carol.
Hi.
Thank you for joining me. So, how would you describe the relationship between Syria and Lebanon at the moment?
The situation has always been a difficult one. Every country, every neighbours hate each other, and it's It's a similar case between Syria and Lebanon. Problem with Lebanon is also more complicated because you have religious communities that exist in Syria that are also in Lebanon. In the case of Tripoli, the northern city you were talking about, we also have an Alawite community and we have a Sunni community. This weekend they were fighting against each other. They live in two neighborhoods that are very close to each other, and they were sending rockets at each other, and the army had to intervene. So it's worrisome, but these things, religious community conflicts kind of erupt every time there's a regional conflict. You feel it in Lebanon. So obviously Syria, which is so close, there's going to be an impact in Lebanon.
So it's quite a complicated relationship from what you're saying, and in terms of those religious communities almost transcend the borders because of their allyship to themselves.
Yes, we have Alawites in Lebanon. A lot of the Sunnis from Homs who are fleeing into northern Lebanon have family in Lebanon, and they're staying with them there. Right now, I think according to UNHCR, the latest report I saw, which is from early Feb, there's about 6,000 Syrian refugees in northern Lebanon. I'm sure the number is going to increase.
Yes.
But the problem, of course, is that Lebanon is not really equipped to deal on a political or on a logistical level with a refugee crisis.
Okay, so just explain for everybody, what was the Arab League's latest decision regarding Syria, and why has Lebanon's foreign minister, Adnan Mansour, condemned it?
Well, the issue in Lebanon is you have on one side you have realists, and the other side you have idealists. The realists tell you that Lebanon shares 80% of its border with Syria and doesn't have a strong army, and it cannot really take position against Syria. This is the position of the government, which also has some pro-Syrian ministers, including the foreign minister. So they're not going to speak out against Syria. On the other side, you have the opposition, which is very anti-Syrian, and which is saying we have a moral duty to oppose the Assad regime, which has done so much trouble in Lebanon, and to support the opposition there.
So out of the realists and the idealists, who do you think is going to prevail?
Right now, I think the realists are prevailing. And I think Lebanon, I mean, because we're such a weak country, we're a small country, we're a divided country, we're not really in a position to, you know, to make moral judgments. I mean, even if we do on a humanitarian level, we fraternize with the Syrians on the other side of the border. We know, I mean, Lebanese have suffered from the Assad regime, so they know how it feels.
I mean, I was going to come on to that. I mean, what is the typical Lebanese view of the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad?
Well, you don't have a typical view. It depends who you ask.
Okay.
You ask someone who's pro-Hezbollah, he'll say they support the Assad regime. You ask someone who's pro-Hariri, which is the opposition, they will say they hate Assad. So that's why we're better off by staying neutral.
It's a complicated situation. I can hear from everything you're saying. But, I mean, I don't know how feasible this is from what you're saying, but what would be the effect if Lebanon did cut its ties with Syria, if at all possible?
It cannot cut its ties. Our borders, we have 80% of our borders are with Syria. We have a lot of economic ties with Syria. Our banks are linked with the Syrian economy. We can never break with Syria. That's why we have an interest in having a good relationship with them.
If you can never break with them, though, I mean, when you think about the violence spilling over into Lebanon, I mean, why are you not better suited to actually try and deal with this type of escalating situation then?
Because we are divided. Because there are different also regional forces that are pushing us in different directions. It's a very complicated situation, and because we're small and because we're divided, there is no clear position.
And to talk more widely about the rest of the Middle East, if Syrian violence did spill over into Lebanon, what would the effect be with the rest of the relations in the Middle East for your country?
Well, I think it could be dangerous because in the south where you have Hezbollah, I mean, it will probably link with Iran. And then on the other side, you have the Sunni population that will be supported by Saudi. I mean, you're going back to the Lebanese civil war where every regional Arab country had a position and had a militia, was supporting one side. So it's complicated.
And I don't know if you can predict the future a little bit for us, but with your experience, do you see a particular side prevailing?
No, I don't. I don't. I think the Lebanese situation has always been a situation of difficult negotiations and never a clear outcome. This has been the same story for 80 years since the Lebanese independence.
Okay.
But that said, from Beirut, it's not that people are in denial, but there is stability till now. I mean, what's happening in the north is very concentrated in certain neighborhoods of Tripoli, and it hasn't really spilled in the country yet.
Okay. Well, I'm sure what you've said about the conflict and the way it's been for 80 years will probably be how it'll be for the next 80 years, but we'll have to monitor it as we go along, and I'm sure you'll still be able to do that for us, taking us through it. That was Carol Corm. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24, and we'll be back with some music after this.
The Globalist bids good night to America, good morning to Europe, and good afternoon to Asia, with 2 hours of analysis, paper reviews, and a run-through of the topical stories shaping the world wherever you are.
There's a lot of money in this country. It's a very strong economy, and it's really growing rapidly, and so it's the natural choice.
Wake up in Europe to The Globalist, live every weekday at 6 a.m. London time, here on Monocle 24.
Every Saturday on The Review, Monocle's editors ditch their jackets and unbutton their top buttons for a cosy weekend look at what's selling at bookshops from Buenos Aires to Brisbane.
This store was insanely busy. It was incredible. So if you had walked in on that day from outer space, you would never have had any clue that people weren't passionately in love with physical books.
A survey of the global newsstand, some fine tracks chosen by a great music guest, and lots of good conversation. Join us every Saturday at midday London time. And remember, this show is best enjoyed with coffee while camped out on your sofa.
Now it's time for our first song. This is Lucy Lucy by Sean Lee. That was Lucy Lucy by Sean Lee. You're listening to Midori House live on Monocle 24. Now, in 2007, Mitt Romney angered animal lovers by strapping his Irish setter to the top of his car during a 12-hour family drive from Boston to Ontario, terrifying the hapless dog and causing a health hazard to fellow road users. Now, his actions seem to have come back to bite him, as this week, protesters from the group Dogs Against Romney set up a demonstration outside the Westminster Dog Show in the US that has generated mass media coverage and a social media frenzy. To discuss the issue, we are joined on the line by Kitty Hendricks, activist from Dogs Against Romney. Hi, Kitty.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you very much for joining me. So, Kitty, at the last check, your Facebook page has clocked up over 27,500 likes. People certainly seem to sympathise with your campaign, don't they?
Yes, well, since the demonstration yesterday, we've picked up 2,000 new members, so it's really quite amazing.
Okay, and I mean, just to give us a tiny bit of background, why did you set this up? Obviously, you know, he's in the limelight, he's running for president, but why have you done this now, and how many, you know, were there of you yesterday?
Well, I think it's interesting. This is a story that, you know, of course, happened in, you know, the 80s. But what's interesting about this is that Mitt Romney generally relies on his public record of the things that he has accomplished in business, et cetera, to prove his worthiness to run as the president of the United States. This is a personal story about Mitt Romney, which I think people, very few people have actually seen also as part of this candidate. And I think having the Westminster Dog Show as a backdrop was probably, it was just a terrific idea. This organization actually is centered in Alabama. But it just seemed to be the thing that resonated with many, many people. And so we decided to hold a very small demonstration, very impromptu. None of the dogs were actors or called upon. They showed up.
Right,
and it was terrific.
You didn't have to strap it. You didn't have to strap any to a car there to make them get there.
No, we didn't even pay for cab fare for these dogs.
Okay, well, shut up. I mean, obviously, we live in the era of sort of personal politics now, and actually, you know, what you do in your personal life is sort of as equally as important as what you do in your political life. How damaging do you actually think this story will be to Mitt Romney's campaign, or do you think it's a bit of a storm in a teacup?
No, I really think that this is going to have a huge impact. Basically because I think also there are so many American voters on the line about whether they are even a Democrat or a Republican. All of these lines are being kind of, you know, a little bit messier than they have been in the past. And I think that the issue of animal rights or the way that a candidate would treat a family member, It just resonates a much deeper on a much deeper level with people, and I think that even Republicans are coming out against Romney. It's very interesting.
I'm sorry to sound skeptical, but I suppose it's because I'm not an animal lover, and I don't feel if I was in America voting that this would affect me. But surely you can see that this might only resonate with those people who do have dogs, and even then, it really might not change the way they vote. If they want Mitt Romney, they're going to judge him on what he's done politically and in the world of business.
I don't actually agree with you, because I think that actually Romney's attitude shows... It kind of shows how he feels about the most vulnerable in our society.
But he didn't strap his child to the top of the car. He didn't strap his child to the top of the car, did he? He strapped his dog.
He didn't strap his child to the top of the car. But there are many people who are animal owners, and even people who just feel that they have no control over their lives, who feel kind of like the system is running them over. And for someone to take the initiative to do something like this is something that they will be considering for a candidate.
Okay, and I mean, building now on your success and the way that this has just caught on, what are you going to do next? How are you going to keep the momentum up? And have you got any plans for sort of future strategy or future protests?
No, I don't think there are any immediate plans. There may be some smaller grassroots demonstrations by dog owners who prefer to do this in other areas. This is the only one we've planned for Manhattan or New York City, and certainly it had the impact that we wanted it to have. So honestly, there are many, many other issues in this campaign and other candidates. And, you know, but I think Dogs Against Romney, I think that what's great about it is the ownership that dog owners are taking into the political process. And they are actually getting engaged and involved. And that's what needs to be done in this country.
How important, though, do you think social media has been in the development of your campaign?
Oh, I think it was... overwhelmingly important. I know we would not have gotten the press there had it not been that within only a number of hours, thousands of people began joining this group that has been around since 2007.
And in terms of your strategy and how you use that, was there a particular, you know, way you decided to use Twitter, use Facebook, and how are you doing it now? Are you shutting down the pages if you're not planning on carrying on, or are you going to keep updating people with information?
Oh, no, the updates are constant. Whoever joins the group and likes the group gets continuous updates. And it's really kind of organic. It's really, where is it all going? It was not created by any kind of political group. These are dog lovers.
Okay. And have you had any response from the Romney camp?
No, actually not.
Really?
No, but the American Kennel Club has come out in support of us, which I think is pretty wonderful.
I don't know if you do know this, but how many people in the U.S. of the voting age do you think have dogs?
I actually wish I knew the answer to that question, and I don't know the answer to that.
Well, they're your target, surely, next, Kitty. You've got to get all of them on board with your campaign.
I think we're all very pleased with the number of people that are getting on board on this campaign right now.
Okay, and
I think that.
Well, let me ask you then, who are you going to vote for, if I may be so bold?
Well, I definitely will vote for a dog lover, which happens to be Barack Obama. So
you're going to stick with Obama. All right. Well, thank you very much for that. That was Kitty Hendricks, who's an activist from the Dogs Against Romney. Very interesting campaign. And I wish her the best of luck, but it doesn't really have my sympathies, sadly. You're listening to Midori House.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 talat ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ja jokas.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
Dobro pozdravljavat. Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Afto je to Monocle 24.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. 24.
Weekends on Monocle 24 are for relaxing, taking stock of the week's events, and keeping an eye on the week ahead. The Review is our hour-long Saturday show, looking back at the books, TV shows, films and events that have made our week, as well as a regular magazine review. Monocle Weekly, our original audio offering, is where it all started. Tyler Brulé, Robert Bound and Andrew Tuck discuss the week ahead with guests, analysis and a good helping of music. Perfect Sunday listening. And if you need a short, concise summary of the week's highlights, look no further than The Curator, in association with Rolex, a one-hour roundup of all the juiciest bits of the past week on Monocle 24. So listen to The Review, Monocle Weekly, and The Curator for the full Monocle 24 weekend experience, either live on Monocle 24, on our timeshift player at monocle.com, or on iTunes.
Still to come in the next half hour on Midori House, we'll be joined in the studio by culture editor Rob Bound to hear what cultural pickings he recommends this week. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
Thanks very much. The Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, has offered to hold multi-party elections within 4 months. While his troops continue to attack opposition strongholds of Homs and Hama, elite Syrian forces backed by armoured personnel carriers also stormed parts of Damascus today. Iran's oil ministry has denied state media reports that the Islamic country was stopping its crude exports to 6 European countries. Iran's English-language Press TV had earlier said that Tehran had stopped exporting oil to France, Portugal, Italy, Greece, the Netherlands and Spain in response to European Union sanctions. Israeli nationals in India have today said that they feel safe despite an attack outside their embassy in New Delhi. India said on Tuesday it was still unsure who was behind the Monday attack on the Israeli woman's car by a motorbike rider who attached an explosive to the rear door and fled. It has been pointedly silent about Israel's accusation that Tehran was the culprit. At least 10 countries, including the United States and the UK, have issued travel alerts to Bangkok in light of the recent bombings in the Thai capital. Ambassadors from more than 30 embassies met at the foreign ministry this afternoon, a day after 3 explosions rocked the busy Eka Mai area in eastern Bangkok. Britain's Queen Elizabeth, accompanied by the Duke of Edinburgh, has attended a Diamond Jubilee multi-faith reception at Lambeth Palace here in London. The Queen and the Duke of Edinburgh met with representatives of the 8 non-Christian religions in the state drawing room, including Buddhist, Hindu, Jewish, Muslim and Sikh, as well as Christian representatives. And finally, in Bogota, a rather strange story. Catholic priests have hired hitmen to kill them. When one was diagnosed with HIV/AIDS, 2 of the 4 assassins were arrested, but both priests were shot dead. And those are the stories at the top of the hour, at the bottom of the hour, here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. It's now time for some music. This is Kelly by When Saints Go Machine.
Sure.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Every day this week, we're joined by a different editor from the Monocle team. And today, it's culture editor Rob Bound. Hi, Rob.
Hello. How's the show?
It's going very well.
I'm very loud. I'm exceptionally loud.
It's all the better for having you here now.
My goodness gracious.
So, what have you been doing this week? What exhibitions are you seeing? What music are you listening to?
Well, I think actually this time last week, I spoke about I'd just been to the Freud, the press show, the Freud thing. Which was sort of amazing, and I wanted to talk about another. I wanted to talk about another art story, which actually is in some of today's papers in the UK. Tony McNerney, who's the head of contemporary at Bonhams, has sort of lashed out. I think that's the phrase you might. I don't know whether you can use the phrase "lashed out." Maybe he hasn't lashed out exactly.
I don't know if anybody who works at Bonhams lashes out regularly, so you should at least talk about it.
Well, they've got a wine cellar; they get lashed.
Right.
But I think it's a tabloid term, right? Lashed out. It's
yeah,
okay.
We can do that.
We can do it. He sort of lashed out at the super rich collectors and sort of said, "Pete, everybody knows the price of art, but they don't know the value of it anymore." Which is obviously a big thing to say coming from the head of a contemporary department. Bonhams as well. Probably best known to people for selling vintage cars and selling vintage watches and, you know, vintage wine and stuff like that, and old masters rather than contemporary art. They've just launched their contemporary market or their contemporary art department. So this is kind of like a kind of balls out gesture by Tony, but it's kind of an interesting thing about the sort of, it sort of shows you the sort of state of the art market that everyone thought it was going to go bust after Lehman Brothers went bust, and of course it's continued on this kind of crazy kind of it's gone mountaineering.
That's one way of describing it. What do you think the impact though of his words will be, if any?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what it affects, other than it's a funny PR story for Bonhams to handle, I suppose. I mean, it's kind of, it's sort of saying, I don't know whether it's saying don't buy from us, and you know, we don't want our prices to reach, you know, it's an auction house. So obviously, the whole point is that it, you know, things get pricier, and at the end of the evening, they make a huge amount of money, and all their investors are very happy, sort of thing. So I don't know whether it sends those signals out. But what it did remind me of was going to the British Museum and seeing the Grayson Perry show. I brought the book in.
Okay. Emma.
This is the Grayson Perry show at the British Museum, the Tomb of the Unknown Craftsman. Now, it's been on for a couple of months, and they've just extended it by a couple of weeks.
Right.
So I went back to see it at last Friday. And it's one of those things, my two anecdotes are not entirely unrelated, because this is the kind of show that makes you acknowledge the value of things, if not and absolutely not the price of them, despite one of our most famous contemporary artists, Grayson Perry, making new work for this show. He puts them in the context of all the treasures that are in the British Museum, and wants you to sort of spot the difference between a shrine that he's made to a little teddy bear that he calls Alan Measles. Say Alan Measles without smiling.
Alan Measles.
See?
Yeah,
you were sort of
difficult.
Smirking.
It was quite difficult.
Anyway, but it made me think of that, and it sort of does. It is that thing where so much of the art you see, in national galleries and municipal galleries is actually sort of, sometimes it is, it's not entirely sort of... unknown that the art market kind of pushes a lot of it in
and
there.
And would you say Grayson Perry's exhibition is accessible to people who don't necessarily think, I want to go and see that type of work, or is it something that's quite niche?
I think it's entirely accessible. I think it should be a permanent collection. I think it should be always on the fourth plinth if you could fit it onto the fourth plinth. I think it's like the most essential.
What's going on with the fourth plinth in Trafalgar Square now?
The fourth plinth, they're having a new one tomorrow, next week.
Oh, are they? Okay.
Yeah, I think it's next week or the week after. Elm Green and Dragset.
Right.
The Danish artists and curators are doing the next thing, and it's a big ironwork something sculpture.
Oh, that'll be exciting.
Mm, it'll be nice.
I can't wait to see
They're witty.
Okay, that'll be good.
You know, you have to sort of describe an artist in a word. Witty.
Did you ever go along when it was, you could go and stand on a plinth
I didn't
and do your thing and talk and dance or whatever?
That was, who was that? That was, what's the very tall sculptor who did the Angel of the North? Anthony Gormley.
I'm culture editor now of Monocle.
Thing.
Just want to say I'm announcing my takeover.
I know. I don't know what's wrong. I don't know what's happened to my brain.
No, I wanted to go and do that.
I'm only able to say Grayson Perry because the name is written down in front of me on the cover of his book.
It is a beautiful book.
It's a nice book. And this is Tony. This is Tony McNerney, and this is his story in today's paper.
Okay.
And as you say, knowing the price of everything and the value of nothing, it's kind of nuts. But it is that thing. I spoke to two gallerists in London last week, Ekin and McLean, who've just opened a show, and they've opened a new gallery in London as a non-sale show. So it's an art gallery, it's a shop, but it's a non-sale show that they've opened with as a sort of goodwill gesture, because there is such a huge amount of money that it is worth a gallery. It is worth two art dealers that run an art gallery to put a collection, in this case of Cy Twombly paintings and works on paper, and put them up that are not for sale, simply to get some goodwill going. And
so
they can afford to do that and
la la la,
and then they do it. And of course, the kind of people that they deal with, the kind of collectors that they deal with, probably never even walk into the gallery. It's all done on the telephone, all the rest of it. You might say that is someone that knows the price of everything and the value of nothing.
No,
I
well,
don't know whether
their people talk to their people, sort of thing.
Exactly.
So
Send me a fax.
What are we... fax?
It's the 90s.
Love it. What are we going to be listening to? Because you have picked
I brought a CD down. This is the album of the week on the Culture Show on Monday, and available all week, and available as an iTunes podcast download.
No less.
Leave a little pause there for people to write that down. Our album of the week was the new album from the phenomenal Hand Clap Band, and it's called Form and Control. They're a couple of DJs from New York, and they released their debut album a couple of years ago. This is new. This is it was out at the end of January.
Okay.
But this single is called Following, and it's out now.
Great.
Should we have it now, or shall I tell you more about them?
I think we should listen while you've explained
the title. Kind of like two kind of DJ guys that sort of have sort of a couple of kind of cool girls in the band for vocals.
Okay.
And possibly pop video purposes.
Well, let's take a listen. Thanks very much to Rob Bound, Monocle's culture editor, for that song. That was The Following by the phenomenal Handclap Band. Very interesting name. You're listening to Midori House.
Wake up in Asia or sip a nightcap in Europe to the Monocle Daily, with 2 hours of analysis and reports on current affairs, culture and business. Hear from experts, authors and editors of far-flung newspapers, as well as our own correspondents, every weekday at 2200 hours London time.
Unlike other African economies since independence, Mauritius has experienced long-term sustained economic growth and development. But what explains this success? Does Mauritius offer a developmental model to its neighbouring African states? Speaking tomorrow at the London School of Economics about the miracle of Mauritius, and joining me now in the studio is Pierre Dinan, a leading Mauritian economist and commentator. So Pierre, Mauritius is a tiny island separated from sub-Saharan Africa. Does its isolated location mean that it's comparable to African states?
It is, as you have said, it's not on the continent, but it is in a way part of. And our nearest point in Africa is the island of Madagascar and also South Africa. So we are part of Africa, but it is true that being in the Southwest Indian Ocean, we display some different characteristics.
So you're going to be talking about the miracle of Mauritius tomorrow at LSE. What are you going to be doing to sort of set that context and how, if you like, the miracle has happened?
Well, as they say, a miracle is God-given. And I'm going to try to show how Mauritius has made the progress it has made for the last 40 years or so since it became an independent country. And I'm going to show how policies, the right economic policies and the right political environment, we are a democracy, have contributed to this progress. And if you want to call it a miracle, so be it. But I think it's more a question of depending on the policies which have been applied over those years.
So what particular policies would you isolate as being the most effective over the past 20 years, let's say?
I think on the economic side, it is the having an open economy. We international trade, for instance, imports and exports added together equal something like 125% of gross domestic product. And this means, therefore, we live by exports. And we have to, because we are a small country without resources, or shall I say our main resources are our own people and the sea around us. And we have to export our goods, like textile goods, sugar, financial services, tourism, and in order to be able to import what we need. But this has terribly, very much helped. You can't live isolated in this globalized world. And I think we made a very good decision about 30 years ago to open up. Take the risks, of course.
Well, that's what I was going to ask, is how has Mauritius's economy developed over the past 20 years?
It has developed at the rate, roughly on average, 5% per year. And it has been able to move from a monocrop sugar economy into a diversified economy where we still have sugar, to a smaller extent, textile manufacturing, tourism, quite important, financial services, also information and communications technology. So it is quite a diversified economy today.
What would you say, though, and I understand you're saying it's diversified, is the main industry, though, in Mauritius, and what explains that success?
I would say that the main industry now is tourism. But I would not like you to think that the others are not important. The other industry is also important. We have left those days when there was one industry, which was sugar. This is completely out now. Sugar is still there. But I mean, we are really diversified, tourism being the leader. But there are others knocking at the door.
And how did the public react in Mauritius when the economic reforms came in 2005? And has the quality of life increased since then?
The standard of life certainly has increased. Just to give you one figure, when the country became independent, as I say, in 1968, the revenue per head, income per head of a population was $225. Now,
wow.
Now it is $8,500.
Wow, again. that is a significant increase.
It is very much a significant
increase. But in 2005, can you just talk a little bit about the reforms that the government brought in and the impact that had on the public?
In 2005, we had a decision for fiscal reform, and we brought down the top tax rate, whether it is VAT or income tax, we brought it down to 15, right through, sort of single tax rate, more or less.
Okay.
And the people reacted very well indeed. This created more dynamism in the economy. Also, the reform meant also trying to be more careful about the budget deficit, and also facilitating business. So that, in actual fact, you know, to have less and less bureaucracy. And nowadays, I think we got very good scores from the World Bank. I think they publish an index every year also, where they measure the doing business facility, and Mauritius scores very well indeed.
And when you look at the global state of the economy, what do you think countries like the UK, America, other parts of Europe could learn from the government's moves in 2005 and subsequently, which has completely changed and diversified Mauritius's economy?
Well, it would be perhaps a bit arrogant to say that the UK and the US should learn from us. I would say that it is important for any country, big or small, to be careful about their public expenditure. And indeed, we are seeing how very large developed countries today are suffering from having sort of overspent and over-borrowed. So this is a story which is important. And indeed, in Mauritius, our public debt ratio is around about, slightly less than 60%, 60%. Still high, but it should be down probably more to around 50. But when you compare this to what it is in the UK or elsewhere, where you reach figures of probably not far from 100%,
yes.
And in some countries at 125%, so there we are. So if you want a lesson, that's the sort of one which I would propose.
Okay, and just finally, looking ahead, how do you see Mauritius developing, let's say, over the next two decades?
I'm glad you asked this question, because from what I have said, it would seem that everything is easy. It's not easy at all. It's not a miracle. It's not easy. We have to continue having the right policies. And of course, now things are not easy because, as I've told you, we live by exports and our main markets are in trouble, in Europe particularly. So, but how I see Mauritius developing is we must continue to be inventive, be more inventive, to be more creative, and to have better productivity. If we do this, if our people carry on in that same mode that we have been doing over the past, then I think we can continue to grow. Of course, we are far from the continent, and we have to continue with our profile, which is to be a platform for investment, people for investment into Africa, into Asia, as we have indeed been doing, particularly with India, to be a platform where people from the developed countries can do business to sort of get into African markets, huge Asian markets, India, China particularly, huge markets. So a sort of link, a sort of platform between East and West.
That's a very powerful proposition. So I wish you and Mauritius the best of luck with that. And thank you very much for joining us, Pierre.
Thank you very much.
Now it's time for another song. Let's have a listen to Animal by Mika Snow. That was Animal by Mika Snow. We're out of time for this Wednesday edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Dawn Trump, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager was Toby Hammond. The Monocle Daily will be back at 2200 London time to start the day in Asia. But next on Monocle 24 is The Entrepreneurs with Jonathan Openshaw, so do stay tuned for that. This has been Midori House with me, Emma Barnett. Goodbye.